and for the duration of their time on death row. We have a serious problem here because people are being tortured in our prisons, in our jails, and people are dying and coming out of prison and killing themselves because this is absolutely an intolerable way to confine people. And I hope that the continued attention to Chelsea's case will affect our policies.
Jay Stranger, I want to thank you for being with us, staff attorney at the ACLU, part of Chelsea Manning's legal team. And that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Noreen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Ravi Karens, Steve Martinez. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our host, Joe Uris. Today, we'll host a discussion on the value of nonviolence and whether the strategy of violent confrontation is valuable or useful.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the 4th Portland Renters Assembly and their March for Housing Rights. The assembly is on August 26th at the Midland Library from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. There will be speakers on the housing crisis and community organizing, personal stories, large and small group discussion about political strategy, but also defending and otherwise supporting each other. Snacks and childcare will be provided. The march is on August 28th. It starts at City Hall at 6 p.m. with a rally and ends at the Multnomah County Building with another assembly. The theme will be Housing Rights for All and will encompass everything from homelessness to affordable housing to tenants' rights to at-cost public housing. More information can be found at kboo.fm under Community Events or portlandrentersassembly.info.
You gotta fight for your right!
KBOO is a co-sponsor of the Double Mountain Brewery and Tap Room's Great Bottle Roundup and Street Party on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. To lower their environmental impact, Double Mountain is working to reuse their bottles. More information about participating in the Bottle Bring Back may be found at their website, doublemountainbrewery.com. Jeff Allworth kicks things off at 11:15 for a talk and signing of his book, The Beer Bible. From noon to 6 p.m., there will be music provided by Left Coast Country, Green Neck Daredevils, and Mile Marker 6. People that bring back bottles for the Bottle Roundup have a chance to win prizes throughout the day. That's on Sunday, August 23rd in Hood River. More information is available on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm. Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services, a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com. Or by calling 503-230-2300.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. This land is yours.
Yeah, a little old Pete Seeger song, good old Arlo, I mean, Woody Guthrie song. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial in Portland, Oregon. This is the Abe and Joe talk radio show. Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Abe is not here, so it's just me, Joe. Number to call, 231-8187. That's 231-8187. Well, I decided on my, you know, being on my own today, we should talk about what's really happening and the degree to which I guess I would call it what I've called it a lot. Friendly fascism is underway, and what its impacts are and what can and should be done about it. I particularly want to address the issue of the enormous temptation to resort to violence in all forms, whether it's the behavior of extreme aggressions in demonstrations and so on, or in fact the notion of violent revolution in this country. And I take my text, as a minister might say, from a very good book by Chris Hedges, Wages of Rebellion, which I would recommend to all of you. It's really good. It's really good. Hedges is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He got essentially tossed out of the mainstream media for his views. And he has continued to be a very important voice for reason and for understanding exactly what's going on in our country and in the world. So let's talk a little bit about this whole thing. Here's the real stuff. Never mind false hopes and funny ideas. One funny idea, which I consider to be essentially very racist, which is a trap that I and many, many other people, liberals and leftists, fell into, was the notion that the color of one's skin is an inherent indicator of one's politics. It might be, and it even should be for many. But the fact of the matter is that our present president, though an African-American, is in fact simply another operator for the established order. And he's talked a good game in getting elected, but most of what he promised, not only because of the Congress, though in large part because of it, none of it's really coming about. Even the healthcare system, so-called Obamacare, seems to have enormous gaps and faults in it, though it's certainly an improvement over what went on previous to it. I really think this is an important concept, because most of us are easily gulled into false hope based on appearance or presentation of self, rather than a serious analysis of the political behavior of the person presenting themselves. Wages, in real terms, are low. They are constantly going lower. The great mass of men and women who work what is nowadays called the middle class, though really it's the working class, is suffering consequent to that. There is an enormous movement of jobs to countries that pay much lower wages because the profit margin is much greater. Prisons have replaced psychiatric hospitals, they've replaced schools, and they've replaced jobs. In fact, if you think about it for just a minute, a person in prison can work for a few cents an hour and is pressured to do so, and in fact would be tempted to do so out of the sheer boredom of what goes on in prison. And of course, the punishments in prison, if you misbehave, are enormous, and the violence in prison is enormous. But that is a replacement, in many cases, for legitimate wage jobs. And of course, when you look at prison, it's poorer people and significantly persons of color who end up in prison, and young people under the age of 18. the war on the wars, the endless wars, which Dwight David Eisenhower, a conservative president, a Republican president in 1960, warned us about, have come to pass. And essentially, this administration, while reluctant to put ground troops into the disastrous war in Mesopotamia, is in fact an engaged party in this. And the result of our messing about in that region has produced a crazy, crazy religious fundamentalist movement, which we call ISIS. So the military-industrial complex is the fat scene. Employment in that scene is the only reliable employment in the society. The global climate change is on us, and though often denied, is pretty close to undeniable. And in one of the most odd things about all of this is the density and stupidity of the ruling class. You would think, if you were very wealthy, that you would look at the data and you would say, well, gee, we better change, we better modify our politics, we better modify our process of making money so that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren will have a nice place to play with their horses and their lovely walks in their lovely woods, which they will own. And by the way, what's happening with the woods should be noted. It is really important to realize that there is a great move on the part of the Republican Party and many in the ruling class to transfer federal properties, particularly wilderness properties, into the hands of state governments where they can be simply turned into opportunities to take resources out of the land and destroy the pristine quality of those lands. This is all real. This is not stuff you can dispute. This is, you can argue about why it's happening. You can argue about who's responsible. You can argue about what the class structure means in all of this. But the facts I'm giving you are indisputable. And that's important to understand. So the problem then becomes, well, okay, so the environment's going to hell with an oncoming rush of terror and horror. Great movements of people will happen. We know that in history in the past, for example, when Lake Baikal in Asia, Central Asia, disappeared, the vast numbers of Turkic peoples moved to the westward, and that changed the course of history through a large period of time, including the creation of enormous wars. We know that these physical changes produce rational behaviors which can be very aggressive and very hurtful to many, many peoples. We understand that. We also know that already we are seeing people fleeing wars and climate change in North Africa and in the what we call the Near East as they rush to Europe to have a chance to survive. And all of this is going on without any real insight or comment on the part of the media. In fact, the large part of the media, exceptions are maybe places like KABU, just sort of tell us about these things to the degree they tell us about them without any real discussion of what the hell is going on. Well, this means that most of us turn it off. What we really do is, well, we get into our own lives. We have our partners, we have our music pleasures, we have our reading pleasures, we have our athletic pleasures, we have our own lives, our families, or whatever, that allow us freedom from these terrors to a great degree. Nobody really wants to spend their lives, maybe a few years of their lives, but not most of their lives, struggling against enormous, powerful forces, which historically, in my lifetime, and as far as I know, in all our lifetimes, end up winning whatever we get in the way of progressive reforms, and we do get them, and they're worth struggling for. Well, really, they don't matter in the great scheme of power. In the great scheme of power, money and national wealth, national treasure has continually flown away from all of us and into the hands of a very few, 1% of 1%, in fact, in this country. So, what do you do about that? How do you operate? I'm going to suggest some ideas, and then I'm going to invite you to suggest whatever you think about that. Tell me I'm full of it, whatever. First of all, there is one overriding way of seeing this, And that is to be existentially active, to be understanding that you may or may not win, but that is not the way you decide what to do. You decide what to do based on what is right. Existentially, you and your children and your children's children will be better off if you can say, well, you know, I did this and I did that and it helped some, or, well, maybe the way we did it didn't work. But we did struggle to keep the world a healthy place and to create social justice and to end racism and so on. To not do that, to simply fall into despair or buy into some paranoid, delusional notion of what's going on, is very, very foolish and certainly feeds the disasters that I believe lie ahead. I don't usually talk this way. I like to go issue to issue, and Abe and I will talk about the various outrages of our time or even things that are good and make us happier. But sometimes I have to stop, and sometimes I think you need to stop and look realistically at what is happening. And yeah, that ain't so much fun, but yeah, you got to do it. And I'm doing it tonight or today. And hopefully you'll join me in that, and maybe you'll find some light, some brightness to contradict my dark feelings, and maybe you'll have some ideas about what to do about it. What I'm going to talk about is the stuff that needs to be discussed in terms of what is to be done. We now know that the analysis of Marx by himself was inadequate to a real understanding of modern society. An example. Karl Marx made a good analysis of the class structure. Excellent analysis. Very little has changed in that respect. But he didn't understand process. He didn't understand war as endless war. He didn't understand, for example, the Franco-Prussian War, 1870. I mean, way back then, he thought, well, if Prussia wins the war, it'll strengthen the working class in Germany, and the German working class is more progressive than the French working class. Therefore, this war is a good war in terms of the interests of the working class. He also could not possibly have predicted what happened in Russia, later the Soviet Union, or understand the process by which non-democratic forces can dominate revolutionary situations. Well, we need to understand that. We really need to understand that. We also need to understand the history of the United States, founded by a group of men, not women, a group of men who essentially were landed gentry, for the most part, businessmen in a few cases, who, in order to create this constitutional democracy, and in many cases pleased to create it, perpetuated a horror called slavery and perpetuated a very racist view, a very sexist view, a very classist view of how to organize a society. It was not their intent to create, in our terms, a democracy in any sense. That's true. Now, it was progressive for its time, but the truth of it is that it was never really designed to be a progressive system. It was not a revolutionary concept in our terms. And obviously, that system enshrined racism and the disproportionate harm done to persons of color in the society endlessly. We are beginning to see some new reactions, some new angers. The Black Lives Matter movement, I think, is a great thing, a very good thing, and a very important thing. We are more and more seeing the way in which the authorities, the police, who are a paramilitary force with weapons given to them by the Pentagon, we're beginning to see how brutal it is. And we're beginning to understand what the prison system really is, as a functional device to hold back and restrain and harm communities, particularly communities of color. This is important. This is really important stuff. Well, so again, what is to be done? One temptation is to express frustration in terms of a violent revolution. The fantasy here is the people united will never be defeated. What one needs to do is what the Black Panthers talked about doing, which little really was done in this sense, go to the gun. Challenge on the terms of the military power, and the oppressive nature of the state. The reason why Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others advocated nonviolence, apart from its moral dimension, which is a big part of it, was that it is a practical way of dealing with power. Speaking truth to power matters, and it works, and it disarms your enemies even as they harm you. It's hard, it's difficult, it's incredibly hard to be a nonviolent resistor, to be a struggler for social justice, and not become frustrated and enraged and make the awful mistake of challenging the enormously powerful, well-armed militias of the state, of the government, on their terms. But realistically, logically, and morally, when you attempt that, you legitimize their power, you reinforce their argument for their power, and in the end, you end up either dead or in jail. So, thinking about this, I argue that nonviolent resistance is more important today than any other way of dealing with things. And I argue that it's probably the only way in which we can effect major changes in our society. It does take enormous discipline. It does take enormous training. It is not a lightweight activity. It is more difficult, I think, than teaching people how to go bang bang with their toys. So I really, really want to address that also on local terms. I want to tell you a story. It's an interesting story. It's not a big deal story, but it's an interesting story. Some years ago, we had one of our peace marches in Portland, and there was various groups, and one of the groups was the Code Pink, okay? Some very nice, largely women, who are opposed to militarism and to injustice. And in front of them, taking the lead, which we see a lot in Portland, was something that is labeled by the media and by sometimes self-labeled called the Black Bloc, which is a quasi-anarchist organizational or non-organizational structure. People get to dress up, the young people, they get to dress up in black, they wear masks, they look scary, they have red and black flags, they advocate anarchy, sort of anarchy. And recently, we have seen people of that orientation taking hold of and leading, grabbing the leadership in various marches and things. And it's kind of cool. You get to disrupt traffic. You get to make a real nuisance to yourself, and you get more news coverage. It's very tempting indeed. Well, in this particular case, they were carrying a flag, which said, F the troops. Okay? So, attacking essentially the fact of the military. No real analysis there. Why do young men and women join the armed forces? Well, there are no other jobs. Patriotism is a dominating force. Yeah, it's not a good thing to be in the armed forces, but what are the choices? What realistically are the choices? And this is true and has been true throughout modern history. So that attack, rather than attempting to find unity and commonality and struggle within the context of the working class situation, is really an outrage. It's an outrage that is understandable, but sort of short-sighted and stupid, and was thought of at the time by many people I knew as kind of funny, because the Code Pink ladies were really upset by this behavior. And the Black Bloc looks strong, it looks cool, it's very tempting, it's kind of, I don't know, what do you want to call it, sexy? So, you know, wow, I want to be in the Black Bloc, it's really, oh man, so cool, you confront the cops, you know, have a fight. Well, yeah, but it's not very disciplined, and it's not very smart, and it doesn't really, really persuade the great mass of people. It just doesn't. A few young people will join you, but in the end, all you're doing is putting yourself not only outside the system, but outside the understanding of most people. On the other hand, when you are willing to risk arrest, when you are willing to risk imprisonment, violence by the authorities, in a dignified manner, with violation of law that is passive, that is resistance, that is not violent. When you are willing to do that, when you are willing to take the sacrifice and the risk, you bring to bear moral power. And in the end, I honestly believe that that is the force that can make change in a world where all of us are disproportionately disempowered by the power of the military-industrial complex. I wanted to say that because I'm getting a little tired of frustrated anger and how little it really accomplishes and how much it feeds into the paranoia of most people who, of course, because of the nature of the media and who owns it, have no idea about what's going on, who in fact are dealing with a Republican Party that is turned to the right and argues that the climate change had nothing to do with people, that they may not even be happening, that the horrible, horrible discrimination and oppression of persons of color and working class people isn't really happening, and so on. Well, you have to speak truth to power. You have to do it effectively, you have to do it often, and you have to be willing to accept the hits, the losses, and the enormous burden that that brings to your life. Otherwise, you're just playing. You know, you're just a player in a kind of a little game that that becomes a ritual. A march takes place. You gain control of the march. You block the street. You piss off a bunch of drivers. You mess with the public transportation system. You get on the news. And that's the idea, I guess. You get on the news, but you're not really conveying much information. And you're not really presenting a serious, dignified struggle against evil in the society. That's where I'm at about this. Now, maybe there's some people out there who really think I'm full of it and they really want to disagree. And I'd love to hear from you. I think this is a discussion long overdue, and I think we should have it. 231-8187. Lee, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
One thing that I have never heard mentioned on KBOO is Howard Zinn's book, Disobedience and Democracy, 9 Fallacies on Law and Order.
Well, you're right. I don't think anyone's mentioned it that I've heard.
Well, it's a book that he wrote. It's a short book. It's about 125, 130 pages that he wrote in 1968. And if I had read it then, I would probably be more revolutionary than I already am.
Uh-huh.
And I think that what he is doing in the book is responding to some writings of Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas.
Uh-huh.
Who wrote something called Concerning Dissent and Civil Disobedience. And Zinn is responding in probably the most intelligent and insightful way I have ever come across.
Can you outline what is said in the book? Is that
okay? Fallacy number 4.
Uh-huh.
That civil disobedience must be absolutely nonviolent.
Okay.
Okay. Fallacy number 5, that the political structure and procedures in the United States are adequate as they stand to remedy the ills of our society.
Mm-hmm.
And fallacy number 6 is that we can depend on the courts, especially the Supreme Court, to protect our rights to free expression under the First Amendment.
Uh-huh.
He wrote this in 1968.
Really prescient.
I'm amazed at how appropriate it is at this day and age.
Well, I did not read it, so I have to unfortunately plead ignorance on this relatively small book. I know his work in a larger context and his people's history and so on. But I do think that the first one that you mentioned disturbs me a bit, because I don't think we have much choice in tactics at this point, because we don't hold the cards.
That's your opinion. I think that Zinn makes a credible argument to say that there are times when, you know, you got to go beyond nonviolence.
No, I think there are too. I'm not being clear enough. I'm talking tactics here, not necessarily morality. Although I also think that moral force is effective and that you're better off going with nonviolence because the state holds all the violence cards. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's opinion. That your opinion. I think that you know, Zinn, because of his standing, because of his intellectualism, is someone worth you know, reading his argument.
And oh, I agree with you
on that.
Yeah.
And you know, while I have not read Chris Hedges, the book you alluded to at the beginning of the program, like I said, I have never heard Zinn's Democracy in Disobedience in Democracy mentioned on KBOO, and I think that's what I'm doing right now.
No, I appreciate that, and I think it is a discussion that needs to be had, and people having read your book probably are better than I at having this discussion. I cop a plea of ignorance here.
Well, I'm pretty ignorant too, so you know, there's a lot that needs to be changed, and I think that for those who want to implement change, you know, Zinn is a good starting point.
Oh, I agree with you in general about Zinn. I have used his book in teaching American history in the university system. So, you know, I like his work a lot. And I, a couple of times I met the guy, he's gone now, of course, and I've always been really impressed by him. He and Noam Chomsky are great figures in my pantheon of wonderful people.
Well, I think that if you would, you know, get the book and read it.
I will.
It would basically take the top of your head off.
I don't want to lose the top of my head, but I will definitely read the book.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.
All right, so a discussion here. Nonviolence as the only method to create social change. Nonviolence as a tactic to create social change. Nonviolence as useless to create social change. I really want to hear from you, and I really appreciate any discussion on these topics. If you're a person who I've now criticized in the so-called black bloc, by the way, that is a pure pejorative that I use for convenience. I think there's much more to that concept than simply putting on a black outfit and a black mask and a red and black flag. And I do respect a lot of the people involved. So I want to hear from you. 231-8187. Lance, you're on the air.
Mr. Proctor, thank you so much for having a sobering discussion about the realities of protests and the world we live in.
Actually, it's me, Joe, but okay, thanks.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. Not important. Go ahead.
Okay. you're right. We don't hold the cards. You're so right. And, I mean, if one reads history, it's pretty brutal. Our system was built on top of that very violence that we're sitting on right now. Mm-hmm. Ask any Native American, they'll tell you.
Yeah.
And I'm so conflicted when I read history and then I see the nonviolent movements, and I just don't know. You know, and there are many people who are looking at this thing and the enormity of it and the sheer danger of it. You're so right on so many points when it comes up to this de facto fascism that we're probably already in and don't know it. And I can hope we all try to think and calm ourselves before we make any action, whether it's violent or nonviolent, because there are circumstances to where we do have to fight for our lives. It's us or the other person. And then there are circumstances that we have to think and stand down. You know, just 100 years ago when all this stuff was happening, we didn't have the type of recording devices that we do today or in the 1940s to say, hey, look, a lot of this stuff is buried. A lot of this history is coming up now, and I'm completely flabbergasted by it.
No, I agree with you. I also, that you bring up something else, which is that the technology of the phone, you know, of the fact that you can take pictures of and record things going on has really changed the discourse in recent times. It's much harder for the police to lie. It's much harder for people to say this happened and then someone else to say that happened when you have actual physical evidence, visual evidence of what really happens.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. That's really a good thing. It's
an amazing thing.
It's the only thing I like about a cell phone, actually.
It's one of the most important tools that anyone in a nonviolent movement will be able to use so that everything is recorded, at least for history purposes. Because a lot of these massacres, a lot of these genocidal acts were done in secret.
That's true.
They were done in secret, and now it's like you. This is a very sobering subject. Thank you for bringing it up, because I'll sit down and watch a nature film with a couple of my friends, and they'll see a coalition of lions do some brutal things, or they'll see baboons do some brutal things, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm glad humans don't do anything. We're so much more civilized." I have to do a double take when I hear people say and act that way.
Well, you know, primates be primates, and we be primates.
I agree. But there's so many people who are very naive about what's going on, and thank you for having such a sobering discussion.
Well, I thank you, and obviously we need more callers, maybe some people who really disagree with me, but thank you very much.
You're welcome.
231-8187. I've argued for civil disobedience, for nonviolence, and been critical of groups that recently have pushed a kind of a violent confrontational approach. I think it would be good if people called me who disagreed with me. I also would like to hear, by the way, from more women. I think it's the nature of our culture that men tend to be willing to talk on the radio, but I'm not sure that that's true. Love to hear from you, regardless of your sexual orientation, and so on. Give me a call, 231-8187. John, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
I'm not a woman, and I'm for nonviolence, so I'm not going to be able to contribute.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I'm very familiar with Chris Hedges, and he is basically a hero for me because he had the fortitude to stand up against the Iraq War at the moment the Iraq War was going to be launched, and so he had the moral courage to stand in the face of a juggernaut that was driving us into the insanity that was Iraq. And he was an Arabist. He was a Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. And he displayed a rare moral courage. There's a lot of times what I would describe it as is a morality of convenience. And it's really rare to have somebody stand up and say very unpopular things in the very moment that those unpopular things need to be absorbed by the culture. What we've performed is a form of insanity in Iraq, both for the Middle East and for ourselves. I mean, part of the incredible economic difficulties that we're suffering under now come directly from squandering our resources in what can only be described as an act of tremendous folly. I think that, and he talks constantly about his, you know, that the urge towards violence is understandable given the circumstances that one may find oneself in, but that what you've said this before as well too, which is basically that the state has so much power and the state wants us to validate their usage of violence against us. If we act out violently, then we give them the legitimacy for them to clobber the living crap out of us. And I would urge people to go back and look at Martin Luther King. And one of the things that his nonviolence, what it did is it had such incredible dignity. And I frequently nowadays, I think of dignity as like a micronutrient that we're all starved for, because you so rarely see it, because you see so many people just kind of shouting insults at each other. And that dignity was rooted in the nonviolence. And I think that dignity was also part of what just drew in many ways drew the nation towards Martin Luther King, and that would not have been present if he had gone the route of violence. So there's my...
Well, thank you for the call. I obviously agree with you. I do understand, though, the rage and the horror and the hopelessness that people face in situations that are much more intimately hurtful than the one I'm in. Sure. And it's really, it's a revolutionary suicide, which was a concept discussed in the Black Panther movement, is an understandable response to the oppression, the continued and unending oppression of, for example, people of color. It is very difficult for most white Americans to understand the history of African Americans in this country, and the argument can be made, and I believe it's correct, that though slavery was ended, the oppression of African Americans continues in different forms, and prisons nowadays are just another example of those forms. Anyway, thank you for the call.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right, 231-8187. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland. I am urging a conversation about my position, which is favoring nonviolent resistance and favoring that approach rather than any other approach to dealing with the horrors that are ensuing consequent to the runaway capitalism and the reactionary forces that are in our society. But I got to do these announcements, get them out of the way. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Alternative Radio, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald, another great person, speaks on why privacy matters. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, the topics are campaign finance in the presidential election, the parliamentary election in Haiti, the exchange of artillery fire between the U.S.-backed Ukrainian military, pardon me, and pro-Russian separatists. And how, AT&T has become an active partner with the NSA's spying program. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to KBOO FM and clicking on the Donate Today spot. Okay, all that and more, but let's get back to our discussion of what I'm advocating, which is nonviolent resistance. And here you're thinking, disagreeing or agreeing with me, 231-8187. Who? Dominic, you're on the air.
Dial your operator.
Timothy, are you on?
Yes.
Go ahead. Talk up.
I want to thank you for this discussion and for highlighting the importance of nonviolence and the dignity and moral certitude that must necessarily accompany it. But I think that there are times to be more confrontational. I like your example of the Black Panthers. A lot of people remember about them is the walking around with guns. They had things like a school lunch program and other, neighborhood defense.
Mm-hmm. And their breakfast program was wonderful. And in Portland, it was a really good program.
Yeah. There are other functions for groups like that. And very often, I'm speaking from the perspective of someone who's transitioned from a black bot bomb-throwing anarchist, figuratively speaking, mm-hmm. to one who is trying to build structures that can survive the pending collapse of capitalism. I call everyone's attention as well to the student protest movement in France in the late 60s, mm-hmm. Which ultimately resulted in spread into the labor unions and resulted in a massive general strike and factory occupations all through Normandy and France. Very little business was done in France during that couple months. And, at least they took about $175 billion out of the economy in mm-hmm. that period. So, it was not exactly a nonviolent period in France. Those occupations didn't happen without injuries.
No, it's certainly true, and rocks were thrown.
Yeah, but it's the dignity and the moral high ground that makes those things successful.
You know, you mentioned the rebellion in 68. And by the way, in France, people who are now quite old who participated in that are known as Soixante Huiters, that is 68ers.
I'm very proud of it.
Yes, yes, and honored in, to some degree in France, even today. The thing that always has surprised me about that, and it was an indication of the failings of the analysis of the Communist Party, which was big at that time in France, was their refusal to join in that. Had they joined, there might have been a revolution in France.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Anyway, thank you. Is there anything you want to add?
Oh, no, that's...
Great. Thanks a lot for the call, man. 231-8187. We're talking about civil disobedience, nonviolent action. I'm citing Chris Hedges' book, Wages of Rebellion. Someone else brought up Zinn's book, which I have not read, Disobedience and Dissent. And obviously something that I need to read and all of you should read. And I think it's a discussion that is very important and needs to be held. We particularly this show, tend to talk about issue by issue, tend to discuss the destruction of the environment, the destruction of working class organizing, the destruction of and continuous attacks on persons of color, on women, and so on. All of that is good. But a big picture orientation is also important. And that's what, on my own today, I'm trying to bring. I ain't the expert. You are. Let's hear from you. 231-8187. Mimi.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having this discussion. You know, I grew up as a person who believed completely in nonviolent disobedience and have been arrested multiple times in nonviolent actions. Mm-hmm. And I guess in the last maybe 8 years, I began to rethink my own strategy and what I think is necessary for certain times, certain causes, and certain moments.
Mm-hmm.
And those do require, in my opinion, in my strategic mind, violence. Not all the time. But again, it's a moment-to-moment thing. And I guess as an example, as somebody who has had people in my family, only a few, die in the Holocaust, for instance, this is an old example,
mm-hmm.
would we do the same thing again? Would we not fight back? If we had weapons, would we not fight back? I think most of us would probably agree. Maybe not all. But many, let's just say some of us would agree that we would fight back. We wouldn't just walk.
Well, you know, you're right. I mean, in fact, and this is important to understand, when there was armed Jewish resistance in Poland and elsewhere, it slowed down the ability of the Nazis to fight their war.
Right. And I look now at the situation we're in with abrupt and rapid climate change. And when we get to the day where only a few people have water. Let's say that some of us in Portland have water saved up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no one else has water, and people find you, they know you have water, and they come to get your water. And you have, you know, ways to protect yourself so that you might want to live longer. I'm just saying, these are just odd scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
You're probably going to protect yourself if you don't want to share your water with them, you know? And again, odd scenarios. But I think that different moments require different actions, and to stick with nonviolent civil disobedience because it's a thing, I don't think that's the only way anymore. I don't think that we can just lay down all the time and say, okay, we're being peaceful, you have an army, you're going to kill us whether we lay down or not, so do we lay down or don't we lay down? And I think that we do have to go back to the things that Malcolm X was saying and how he said what he said, because it's really important to understand. If you come at us with this, will we return with that? How are we going to deal with it? And anyway, I guess my point is, it's not, we have to move away from the PC-ism of saying, well, nonviolence is the way, as if it's the only way. I don't think it's the only way anymore. And again, I went to a Quaker school, so I grew up entrenched in nonviolent action. And I am seriously, I've been rethinking it, and I no longer believe in it. I no longer believe in it as a 100% effective means in strategy. I think there are other strategies.
Well, I really appreciate your comment. And I did not mean to imply, well, maybe I did. that nonviolence is the only strategy. I guess what I really am saying, and it's really important, is that when you don't hold the weapon card, when you don't have the ability to organize a revolution in the violent sense, you need to reach out to people, particularly to your potential comrades, buddies, partners, women, and so on, who are in the same situation and have the same logical interests as you. Nonviolence speaks to them far more effectively than anything else, particularly in this culture. But I understand what you're saying, and I don't dismiss it.
Right. No, and I don't think that you are dismissing it. And I also think that the term dignity is it's a great word. It means a lot, and it can be used on both sides of this. It can be used with dignity in nonviolence, and dignity is also a useful term in acknowledging different strategies that aren't necessarily nonviolent. That's dignified as well.
I really appreciate your comment. I think this is an important discussion. I wish we had more time to do it. But unless you have something else to add, I'm going to let you go.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much for your call. 231-8187. I'm advocating civil disobedience and nonviolent action. We just had a very interesting call from a person who grew up within that tradition and is now doubting the efficacy in many circumstances, not always, of nonviolent resistance. I want to hear from you. Again, 231-8187. Robin.
Hi. I just wanted to say, when I was in New York a while back, I heard over the radio about an app you can get on your phone from the ACLU.
Uh-huh.
So if you find yourself in a situation where you're taking pictures of something, you can send it directly to them in the event that your phone may be confiscated. If you shake your phone or something, it goes directly to the ACLU, so you won't lose it.
Do you have their address?
No, I don't.
But I guess if you typed in ACLU, you'd get it. Yeah.
Right. I just wanted to say that. It might be a good...
No, that's very useful. I think documenting misbehaviors and behaviors of authority are very, very important. Now, of course, all of us are dealing with the reality of a media totally outside of places like this and a few magazines and newspapers, totally in the hands of the ruling class. And even to the degree that some are liberal and some are conservative, basically, they're all establishmentarian, and we all need to realize that. We're not really getting all the news we need. And if you watch local news on television or national news on television, you suddenly realize their slant, their approach is incredibly bad. I mean, it gets bad to the point of wonderment. They will talk about something and never mention where it happened. I mean, it's bad. Anyway, I thank you for the information. It's good to remind us of the function of the ACLU and the usefulness of documenting stuff.
Right, okay.
Thank you. Good. 231-8187. We're talking about my argument for civil disobedience and nonviolence as a strategy and perhaps a philosophical approach to the incredible power of the warfare state and of the American friendly fascism that I believe overwhelmingly dominates our culture. My argument again is that we are a culture that was born in racism, that was born in a differential power, it was born in limiting democracy. Each of the struggles that have happened since then have moved back and forth, but basically there have been some progress, but by no means are we the democracy we pretend to be. And I'm using as my text for the day, The Wages of Rebellion by Chris Hodges. Hedges, pardon me. 231-8187, who do we got? Paul, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, Joe. Thanks for bringing this subject up. I couldn't resist calling in.
Sure.
So I'm a little confused. So is it philosophical or is it strategic?
Well, I'm a little confused, too, and the answer is both.
Okay. Well, it seems like if you're saying that it's a problem of organization, you seem to be, that was what you were kind of going at, it's a problem of being able to organize, because if you organize on the basis of, like, armed insurrection or revolution, obviously you're not going to be able to get very far, which seems to be a problem.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
That's one thing I'm saying, yes.
Okay. Because what it seems like is one of the problems that's inhibiting organization is exactly the philosophical difference between those who are committed morally or ideologically to nonviolence and those who may not be so committed. So that seems to be one thing that actually inhibits organization, the ability of people to get together to unite and fight this thing, which seems to be a problem.
Well, it is a problem, and there are, and you're outlining something which, when we used to have these kind of discussions in Marxist groups and stuff, we would talk about different tendencies. But indeed, there is a significant philosophical difference, and a couple of callers made, I think, a significant point. There is a difference between it as an absolute philosophical position, Cornel West and others hold that, or as a tactic, and that. That difference is important, and I think it needs to be highlighted.
Because I think the problem is sometimes if you preemptively preclude certain things, then you actually inhibit the ability to organize. And also, things are situational. So one thing that seems violent or something in one context may not seem in another, but unless you get to the point where you build to the point where you're able to change the relations of force that you're talking about, you're basically talking about that we suffer a great imbalance in relations of force, which makes us unable to organize. So unless you actually are able to organize, this is kind of a catch-22 argument, if you're able to actually get together enough to organize so you can change those relations of force, you might actually change the field of battle such that things are possible that weren't possible before. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, and I think you're making a really good point. My position on this right now is that there is a tendency, which I think is ineffective, to have small groups kind of wanting to do things that are symbolically significant but pretty much pointless, like let's go out and fight the police. Well, they'll always win in terms of the tactical situation. You may win a moral victory, but you'll get your head bashed in and you'll end up in jail. You're not going to win because they hold all the cards. They're wearing armor. They have mechanized forces. They have any kind of weapon they want, whether it's using a stun gun or blowing your head off. It's tactically significant that you have to use an other approach. And I argue that nonviolence presents a more moral position that the public can comprehend.
Can I make one more quick point?
Sure.
To another call? Okay. Back to the heyday of the what was kind of the larger scale, like mass mobilization movements, the anti-globalization, which led to Seattle and stuff. Anyway, after Seattle and before 9/11 in D.C., I was there and going to some parties and stuff and talking to people. And apparently the whole black bloc discussion had really come up. Mm-hmm. And actually was being addressed by the various parties. I mean, at kind of high levels. There are actually discussions, you know, I couldn't even name names because I don't even know them. I don't know if I would because maybe they don't want this to be known.
Probably they don't.
There were labor unions. There were large NGO groups of representatives, potentially, and black bloc people were actually talking together. And the result, from what I understand of those conversations, is that the next mass mobilization that was going to happen just before 9/11 was a takeover, instead of just like the usual summit confrontation like the IMF, World Bank, they're actually going to take over the D.C. General Hospital, which was being privatized because it was a symbol of, you know, global capitalist neoliberalism. And then, they were actually talking together about that, because people on all sides were getting the point that they needed to actually talk together and develop a common strategy and develop what Lisa Fithian calls points of agreement.
I did not know about this. I'm glad you're telling me.
Anyway, so, and then, you know, 9/11 changed a lot. Anyway, that's all I got to say.
I really appreciate it, Paul. And don't hesitate to call if you want to.
All right.
Thank you. 231-8187. Do we have time for anybody? One really quickly. Go for it. Jane.
Yeah, I guess what comes to mind to me is that there is a tactic of violence. And there are those people who say, I don't do violence. And then I guess I want to say us and them. Then there are those that say, that's cool, you know, then I'm just going to walk over you. Mm. I remember a picture from the 60s of a protester setting a daisy in the barrel of a rifle.
Hey, I'm really sorry, man. We've run out of time. I appreciate your call. We'll talk about this another time. Thank you very much for the call. Really, stay tuned to KBOO. As far as I can tell and as far as I can do, we're going to have some more fundamental conversations as well as talking about issues of importance. You stay tuned. Best in music and best in public affairs broadcasting. KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater in Portland. This month, La Peña's show features artists from the Bay Area and France, including Andrea La Calena, Cristo Cortez, and Ricardo Diaz y Brenna McDonald. Again, that's Peña Flamenca de Portland, August 30th at the Headwaters Theater, located at 55 Northeast Farragut Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the African Hip Hop Caravan Benefit Show, August 29th, from 3 to 6 p.m. at Columbia International Cup in Portland. All ages are welcome to this benefit show featuring Mike Crenshaw and Rashid Jamal to raise funds and awareness for their November trip to various countries in Africa. Again, that's a benefit show for the African Hip Hop Caravan on Saturday, August 29th.